Now we're visiting the parish of Gweedore in County Donegal and unpacking the legacy of Lord George Hill, a prominent landlord whose influence shaped the landscape and livelihoods of this community for generations. Hill introduced agricultural innovations and was known to be a relatively benevolent figure during the famine period. These actions were lauded by many, but as we'll hear, some of the ways he used his estate led to severe unrest in the area. I'm joined in studio by writer and broadcaster Cathal Portair. He's the author of the recently published book An Tírne George Hill, agus Pobal Gweedore, tá an leabhar scríofa as Gaeilge, agus tá an tuadar an seo inniu, tá fáilte roimh Cathal. So the book is in Irish, in case you didn't get that. So begin, if you would, by making it clear who we're talking about, who was Lord George Hill.
Lord George Hill was one of the Hills of Hillsborough Castle, a very, very, very wealthy family at the time. Unfortunately for Lord George, he was the fifth and posthumous son of the second Marquess of Downshire, which meant basically that he wasn't mentioned by name in his father's will and depended largely on his older brother, who became the third Marquess, and his mother until he got some money to call his own, really, which didn't happen until his mother died. But now, he wasn't poor, far from it. You know, he was wined and dined. He would have gone with the mother to meet the king and queen in England. They met royalty and leaders in France and Germany and all over the place. So he was very well set up.
I think your point being that the lands in Gweedore was not passed down to him, that he basically bought it when he did come into his own,
He started buying land in Gweedore within about a year or two after his mother died, when he was given a sizeable legacy. He bought 20,000 acres in Gweedore. Previous to that, he had spent a year or two as an MP for County Down. He had spent a number of years as the controller of the Lord Lieutenant's household in Dublin Castle. And again, you know, it wasn't an onerous job. Someone called him a glorified party organiser, which may well be true. But it kept him in contact with the great and the good, so that when he bought into Gweedore before the famine and started making the changes that he wanted to make in the agricultural practices there and in how the estate was run, he was able to call on quite a lot of experience from how his mother and his brother had handled their estate, and they were seen as being very good landlords. But also, when times got hard and the famine kicked in, he knew all the strings to pull. He knew the people who were in power, and he knew how to get as much aid as he could into the area.
And unusual as an Irish landlord, because one of the characteristics of Irish landlords is they did not invest in their estates, and he did invest a lot in infrastructure around Gweedore. Tell us some of the things he established.
I suppose the main things that he did was he improved the harbour so that it could take reasonable sized vessels, which turned out to be important for relief aid during the famine years. He built a new mill. He built an ice house. He built a dispensary. I suppose the jewel in the crown of his estate, as far as he was concerned, 1842, he opened the first hotel in the area, the Gweedore Hotel, that the local people called an Hortch. Now, there's a new hotel on the same site that was built maybe 25 years ago or thereabouts. You know, he improved roads, bridle paths, set up a school, built a Church of Ireland church, brought merchants into the area to set up businesses, you know, a bakery, a tavern, and the shop that he set up as part of the store sold basically anything from a nail to an anchor or whatever the
phrase is. So he was what they call an improving landlord.
Absolutely an improving
Which is
landlord.
An ambiguous phrase as far as tenants are often concerned in Ireland. Yeah. They didn't always like improving landlords.
Yeah. When he became landlord there, the first thing he did was he brought in two surveyors to survey the whole half of the parish that he owned, I suppose the whole parish, so that he knew exactly how much he had and where it was. He then tried to break up the traditional style of agriculture in the area.
This is the Rundale. Explain the Rundale system, because it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated, so I'll do it as quickly as I can. There's an infield and an outfield. So the infield was the land near the cluster of dwellings, which a lot of geographers...
And it was communal living, basically, wasn't it?
To a large extent, yeah. So you had the infield, which is where they grew crops. You had the outfield where the animals, the cattle and the sheep were sent, particularly during, we call it the summer months, the summer half of the year from May to November. So that meant that the crops could grow in peace. And then when the animals were brought down again, the crops had already been harvested and their manure was used to get that land ready again for the next year. So there's good environmental thinking behind
and
it.
And there were also attempts made to ensure that there was equality when it came to if you had a bit of good land here, you had a bit of bad land there and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So it wasn't, land was passed on in this system, not by primogeniture where it went to the oldest son, which would have been the case, we'll say, with Hill or a lot of people like that. It was passed down, I think, to all the males of the family. I'm not sure that the women got very much. So that would have been okay at the beginning of the system where I left you and your one brother two bits of land, piece A, B and C, good, bad and indifferent and the same to the other. But as that goes on from generation to generation, the holdings are getting smaller and smaller and more mixed up together. And it was causing disagreements among people about who owned what bit.
I mean, the curse of subdivision was bad enough, but when you then are doing that within a Rundale system, which is supposed to be a communal system, you can imagine the kind of, as you say, the rows that went on. He attempted then to end that. Tell us about the kind of the unique system that he himself adopted in order to try and get rid of the Rundale system.
He had hoped to have nice little square farms where people would be asked to move from where they were, build a new farmhouse and have a square farm around it that would be wonderfully mathematical and logical. But the people said, well, look, that's not going to work because, if a house is there, that's where the good land is, and that guy gets all the good land. If the house is over there, that's all bad land. He's going to get all the bad land. So in the end, a local committee was set up, and they decided to strip the land. So what you ended up with was very long, long, narrow strips of land, some of them not that much wider than the house itself, and they were small houses. And they would run from the hill right down through to the shore so that people had access to the shore, to collect seaweed.
So it's a variation of Rundale, basically, isn't it?
Well, it was a bit more logical. And it was also, one of the things about Rundale was that the holdings weren't marked off by walls. Mm. So this was, which meant the people lost a tiny little bit of land on the wall on either side. But they finally accepted it. And this would have been happening through the early 1840s. And there wasn't any great trouble about it. There might have been some slight resentment, but the local priest and the local parish committee accepted, okay, we're going to do this.
When it comes to researching Hill, obviously he helped you greatly because he wrote a book himself called Facts About Gwydor, but also you mentioned the hotel and the visitor's book from this hotel, which opened in 1842, was still in existence.
Oh, there are two volumes of visitor's book, and people did their notes on what they thought of the hotel, how they'd been treated, what they thought of the area, and it just goes on from the hotel opens from 1842, right through the famine and way up until Hill dies. And the two books, I don't think their existence had been known about 30, 40 years ago. And they turned up and they were handed over then to the Donegal County Archive. And not only are they there to be consulted, but they're also online and you can go through them online.
Amazing.
There's some wonderful stuff in it of how the reality of what's happening outside the hotel is totally ignored by the great and the good who came for the shooting, hunting and fishing.
Mm. And he wasn't exactly a resident landlord, but he wasn't an absentee landlord either.
No, he built his main residence outside Remelton, Ballyar House. And his first wife died before she could move in with the children there. He was married twice. He married a niece of Jane Austen's, the writer, and had four children with her. But the fourth child, who was born in Letterkenny, his wife died within days of the birth. So after the funeral, Hill and the children went to England, and one of her sisters started to look after the children there. So Hill was sort of coming and going. This is round about the time the hotel opened. And in the end, they sort of said, look, this isn't working. So she said she was happy to move and look after the children in Donegal. And after a number of years, they fell in love, got married and had a child of their own, even though they were both in their 40s.
So he married two nieces of Jane Austen.
Yeah.
OK, the famine Obviously, a lot of controversy about landlords during the famine. A lot of Irish landlords took the opportunity to clear their estates of impecunious tenants. What about Hill?
The two things that I think most stand by Hill is that between 1841 and 1851, the two census years, that the population in Gweedore didn't go down as it did in most places in Ireland. It actually went up.
Well, that's extraordinary.
Yeah. And the other thing was, in the 40 years that Hill was landlord in Gweedore, no one was evicted permanently. A few people that he was having trouble with were sort of put out for a while and basically said, we'll be good now, and we're allowed back in again.
That was typical of the notion of the caretaker. You get evicted, but you become the caretaker on the land, and then, you know, once you're a good boy and you pay up, everything is fine.
So I think one of the things that stood by Hill during the famine, well, number one was the infrastructure that he put in. So you had the harbour. You also had, in his new mill, apparently, the grinding stones, burr stones that he had put in, were capable of grinding the Indian meal, which wasn't possible anywhere else for another 30 miles on either side. So without that, there would have been serious problems. So you had that. The other thing was, he was happy to sell below cost price, which didn't please the government because it was against government policy. You're supposed to keep up the market price. Mm-hmm. And he decided that the local people couldn't afford the market price, so he was happy to sell below market price.
But he also didn't collect rent for 2 years, didn't he?
Well, yeah, for the full year of 1845-46, he didn't collect any rent that year. And then a number of years later, when there was another really bad harvest, he let the tenants off a third of that year's rent as long as they'd pay the full rent the year coming.
Now, there are differences of opinion about Lord George Hill. There's no differences of opinion about his son, Sir Captain Arthur Hill, who was a complete evicting landlord, who was a horrendous person, as you know. But one of the things, one of the things that is held against him, he has been accused of superism. He has been accused of the Bible in one hand and the soup in the other hand. Was he a super?
No, I came across absolutely no evidence for that. And the only place I actually have found claims of that were in a pamphlet that was written, I suppose, nearly as a reply to Facts from Gweedore by a Belfast journalist called Dennis Holland, who wrote a wonderfully vindictive pamphlet about all landlords in Donegal. And he accused Hill of superism. But I haven't come across that. You know, there was a House of Commons Select Committee set up in 1858 on the subject of destitution in Gweedore and Clonmacnoise. And priests and landlords and tenants and various other people will call to give evidence. And there's 400 pages of evidence printed in the report on that committee. And not once in that report is there a mention of superism ever having happened. And it was set up because there were so many complaints by the landlords about how the tenants were being treated. But that didn't feature at all. He did set up a Church of Ireland school there. And he did have a Bible reader, but I haven't come across any examples of superism, either on the written record or as part of the folk record.
Probably more controversial than that were the so-called Gweedore Sheep Wars, where he practiced enclosure, essentially, about 100 years after the practice was widespread. Tell me about the Gweedore Sheep Wars, what they were all about.
Yeah, I think after the famine, he was hit financially, like a lot of landlords were here, there and everywhere, and he hadn't tried to cut his losses by getting rid of tenants and such like. So I think he was looking for any possible income streams that he could set up. And one of them, and it had been very successful in Scotland for years and years and years before that, was to turn some of the land over to sheep farming. So he invited in sheep farmers from England and Scotland. There were three main ones. And land that Hill had always regarded as being his own because he had bought and paid for it, but that the local population regarded as being commonage because it had always been treated as commonage. He had a large part of that fenced off, and then he let that land to these sheep farmers. But the local people then weren't allowed to use that land to graze their own sheep and cattle, which they had been allowed to do before that. And that caused huge problems because, number one, they didn't have as much grazing as they had before, felt that they couldn't have as many sheep or cattle or make the profit that they had been able to make before. They were also fined if their animals trespassed onto this land and were taken off to the pound, and they had to pay fines to get it out. So that was the first sign of real friction between Hill and his tenantry. And it got worse and worse. And at one stage, a group of, I suppose you could call them Molly Maguires or Ribbon Men or whatever, came into the area and physically attacked a number of the shepherds, made death threats to them, destroyed buildings that were set up to house them, and sheep started to go missing or be maimed and destroyed around the place, to the point that more police were sent into the area. And in the end, the entire population of Gwydor were fined for the sheep that had gone missing or had been maimed. Now, local people and the local priests said, well, look, local people weren't actually doing this, or they certainly weren't responsible for all of it.
But they were liable to it on the basis of compensation claims.
But they were liable to
it.
So there was what was called Cáin na Gaorach, the sheep tax. And then, of course, because all the extra police had been sent into the area and billeted on them,
they had to pay for that,
they had to pay for that as well. So that meant that they're actually paying probably more in those fines and taxes than they had been paying to the landlord for rent before that. So that was a very touchy period. And Hill himself basically got offside for some of that. He was really annoyed that his bailiffs and the people that he employed weren't willing to inform on the people who had been involved in the sheep stealing. And as his punishment to his tenants, he decided that he would take himself off from Gwydor and didn't appear in the place for a year and a half or 2 years. I don't know that the local people saw that was a terrible punishment to them, but however. But that was why the big inquiry was held after that on destitution in Gwydor and Clochaneely, because the priest and tenant side actually got themselves quite well organised and ran a campaign in the newspapers, a publicity propaganda campaign against Hill and the other landlords. And newspapers that previously had, like The Nation, who had been lauding Hill as an example to all Irish landlords, ended up turning on Hill and claiming that any destitution or poverty in the area was due to what he had done or hadn't done, and the same for the other landlords.
Okay, so obviously Donegal had some atrocious landlords. His son, Captain Arthur Hill, John Adair, the Glenbey evictions in 1862, Lord Leitrim, who was assassinated, he's so hated, shortly before the beginning of the land war. Where do you stand on the legacy of Lord George Hill? Because there is a little bit of ambiguity.
Yeah. He most certainly did more good than harm by a huge extent. You know, if I were marking an exam, I'd have him up at 70% for doing most things properly, I think. There were a number of things that he didn't do. I think he could have been more conciliatory when he decided that he needed to make more money. He could have offered the tenantry the option of paying a small increase in rent to be allowed to graze their sheep and cattle as they had done previously. That ended up 2 years after 2 years of the Gwydor Sheep Wars. That's what solved it in the end. They decided to do that, and everything basically sort of went back to normal. And for the last 15 or 20 years of his life, there was little or no trouble that I can find on the estate after that. So I think when you take into account the background that he came from and the mentality that he had, where he had been a major in the army for a few years, where he would expect his orders to be obeyed, and they weren't always. But he just strikes me as a man who was quite reasonable, and saw all of what he was doing there as largely being part of his Christian duty. Because with the money that he inherited, he could have invested it in East Ulster, in linen,
railway stock,
those sorts of things. Yeah. But he'd visited Gwydor in 1832 and then bought the land without having ever gone back. It had sort of affected him so much. And when he got money, 5 years after that, he went and bought half the parish.
So we've been talking about the life and the complex legacy of Lord George Hill. It's explored in the new book, which is called An Tírne George Hill agus Pobal Gwydor, Maradúrch me tá sé scríofa as Gaeilge. Tá beagán béirle an ceapam, presumably the Commons reports, for example, the committee reports would be in English.
Yeah, any of the written evidence from the time I've given in English, because it was in English.
The author is my guest, Cathal Portair. Cathal, gur na míle maith agat.
Gur na maith agat, Ian Miles.